And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to episode 125 of the Keith Law Show. I am 1/8 of the way to 1,000 episodes. No promises there. My guest today is the great cookbook author and other sorts of books author, Michael Ruhlman, whose work I think I have been praising for over a decade now. He has a brand new book out called The Book of Cocktail Ratios, which is absolutely superb if you are at all interested in the art of making cocktails, craft cocktails in particular, at home. It is essential. I've already recommended it to multiple people, and I think it's going to be it is a great gift idea. Buy that and maybe one or two of the pieces of equipment that he recommends, and you have a whole gift for anybody in your life who is interested in good drink and good spirits. For subscribers to The Athletic, I had my second mock draft of 2023. The draft itself does math in head, 18 days away as I am speaking. This is the second of a planned 4 mock drafts. I will have another one next week and then a final one the day before or possibly 2 days before the actual draft itself. Didn't have a ton of changes at the top. It did have a ton of changes throughout based on new information and also just exploring different scenarios based on the things that I've heard and what groups of players, specific teams might be interested in drafting. I will also be doing a Q&A to answer questions on that mock draft on Thursday, June 22nd, possibly at 2 p.m. That time might change a little bit depending on what else is going on our site at that time. And we'll also be doing a minor league blog post this weekend. I'm going to see Jackson Holliday. By the time you hear this, I will have probably seen him. Again, I've seen Jackson Holliday before, but wanted to get a fresh look since obviously he has now emerged as one of the very top prospects in all of minor league baseball. Now it is my great pleasure to be joined by Michael Ruhlman, who is the author of many cookbooks in my house, including Ruhlman's 20, probably one of the most important cookbooks I own. He has a brand new book called The Book of Cocktail Ratios, which I recommend very highly. It just came out. And you can also get more of his thoughts on his Substack, which is Ruhlman, Ruhlman.substack.com. Michael, thank you so much for joining me.
I'm thrilled to be here.
So let me dive right in with the new book. Can you tell us all the ways in which the vodka martini, shaken, not stirred, is sort of a catastrophe of violating many of your rules and guidelines about cocktails?
That's a good place to start. James Bond is not good for cocktails.
No.
No, the Vesper's a decent cocktail.
But, I do like a Vesper, but I can only have one. If I have two, I'm done for the night. Yes.
One that uses vodka. Vodka has sort of steamrolled the spirits market in America through marketing, not because it tastes better or because the quality is better, but just because it's they convinced people that it was easier on your body and resulted in less of a hangover, which just is not true. Then it's shaken. And you do not shake a drink that should be stirred. A drink with just alcohols, such as a vodka and vermouth drink, only needs to be stirred. If you shake it, it gets overly diluted, and just it becomes just unpleasant to drink. So, if you wanted people to leave your house quickly, I would serve them a vodka martini.
It bothers me because it's an ontological flaw. Like it's a martini. Martini must have gin, otherwise, it's a different drink. We have other names for these drinks. I think you said Is that the one that's actually a kangaroo?
Yeah, that's actually a kangaroo. There is a name for it.
Never heard in my life because people just say a vodka martini, or now it's like an espresso martini. Or that's not a martini. Just because you put it in that glass, it is not a martini. It's not beef Wellington if you use chicken, right? It just, you cannot do that. And it bothers me on a very fundamental level.
Thank you. But it's an uphill struggle convincing people to order a kangaroo at the bar.
Oh, we've lost. We've completely lost this battle. But it does lead into what is so great about this book and why I've already, and I've only had it for a week or so, have recommended it to several friends. So for folks who don't know Michael's work, one of his earliest books was just called Ratio, which was cooking ratios and for all kinds of different dishes. This is such a natural transition because, as you explained in the book, all cocktails essentially come down to ratios, and you change one ingredient for another, maintain the ratio, you've got a different drink. And you may capture different elements, positive or I guess possibly negative too, by making those changes. But fundamentally, in your view, the art of crafting cocktails is really just about the ratios.
A cocktail is defined by a ratio. A Manhattan is two parts spirit, two parts whiskey, one part sweet vermouth plus bitters. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in cooking, cooking's a lot different. Like, if you're, the bread ratio is five parts flour, three parts water, plus some yeast and salt. How well you mix the dough, proof the dough, and bake the dough will result in different breads. But it's very hard to screw up a cocktail as long as you measure properly and stir it or shake it. There's just two methods. You add all the ingredients to a cup, and either shake it or stir it and strain, and that's your cocktail. So it's very easy to perfect cocktails at home. And that's kind of why I wrote the book, was to simplify cocktails in this era of complex craft cocktails, in which cocktails are becoming more and more complicated with different whiskeys, Amaro and vermouths and all kinds of stuff. So I just wanted to simplify the cocktail, because we don't need a ton of cocktails. You go to a craft cocktail bar for a new cocktail or to see what they're drinking, or to have a drink that uses an expensive liqueur, like, and if you want an aviation, you don't want to go out and buy a whole bottle of creme de violette. That's where you go to a craft cocktail bar. But at home, you just don't need that much. You need the basic spirits, you need a sweetened dry vermouth, you need a couple of liqueurs, and then you're good to go.
Yeah, one of the things I really enjoyed is your discussion of some of those, really of how to stock a home bar. We can get back to some of the equipment stuff. I do want to talk a little bit about that. But you're big on Amaros too. And I have really only in my 40s, I'm 50 now as of a few weeks ago, but really come to appreciate them a lot more. And I think a lot of it is just, you know, as we get older, our palates are more open to bitter flavors and we're less drawn to sweet. And it's also in my somewhat limited experience, but traveling either to bars or to restaurants that have their, you know, it's very big now, every restaurant with a bar, oh, here's our house cocktail menu. The first thing I look at now is what Amaros are they using? Because that can make a drink, make or break a drink, really. And to me, it can make a drink really interesting. And I would really be curious your opinion too. Is that, have you also seen that, whether it's a rise in the Amaros or maybe a return of the Amaros? Because obviously a lot of these drinks date back decades and they become much more popular more recently.
Well, Amaros are a fairly recent addition to our Amari, rather. That's plural, Amaro,
yes.
Singular.
See? Yeah.
they've really only recently become part of the cocktail lexicon. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot, there's countless Amari. But the ones that I call out for in the book are Averna, Montenegro, Chinar, which is an artichoke based Amaro. My favorite is Nonino Quintessentia, which is used in a paper plane, which mm-hmm. is a relatively new contemporary classic, and then a really bitter Fernet Branca. And these really do, they give accents that a cocktail wouldn't otherwise have. Try making a paper plane. I, if you like cocktails, go buy a Nonino Quintessentia and make a paper plane with that, and you'll see how powerful an Amaro can be in a cocktail.
Do you find that that certain Amari work better? I'm going to make up an example. I don't know if this is true, but, you know, say Montenegro, which is one of the ones I actually like enough that I can just drink it straight as an after-dinner drink. Mm-hmm. That they pair particularly well. Like, this one goes better with rum. This one goes better with bourbon. Or do you view them all as, this has lots of different uses, and it's just going to add different things based on whatever the foundation of that particular cocktail might be?
Well, different Amaros have different flavor profiles. Some are sort of piney and alpiney and have that woodsy flavor. Some are more citrusy, fruity, vegetal. They're going to change the cocktail. And you can only figure out how you like them by practicing and experimenting. And the way I love to experiment, you know, I would make cocktails. I wouldn't make full cocktails because they're a ratio. You can do two parts to one part whiskey to sweet vermouth by doing a tablespoon and a half tablespoon. And it's going to taste exactly the same, pretty much. And so that's a good way to add, you know, use a teaspoon of Amaro in an ounce drink, and you'll see how powerful they are.
Let me give readers a little bit of a quick background to the organization of this book. Like a lot of your books, you always set up, I think, of Ruhlman's 20, where every chapter is based around either a single cooking technique or a single very core ingredient like the egg or salt. Here you break down the cocktail world mostly into its eight categories, I believe, eight sort of master categories. And you have a section at the end for drinks that don't fit into this taxonomy. But to me, that is, I found that an extremely useful way to kind of organize drinks in my mind. And in your experience, you talk to a lot of experienced cocktail bartenders, cocktail makers, people who've come up with their own cocktails. Do they view the world in the same way? That's, I'm just coming from these basic archetypes. And then, especially, you mentioned the paper plane, the Little Italy is another contemporary classic, that they're experimenting or expanding outward from those core categories that you discuss.
Sure. All bartenders know this. The stuff in my book is not new information. It's fairly obvious, and bartenders know it. And some people call it the Mr. Potato Head effect, in which you basically swap out one spirit for another, and it changes the whole drink. Mm-hmm. I don't really like the Mr. Potato Head metaphor, because what you're really doing is you're changing the potato. You're removing the potato and putting a different potato in with the funny eyes and funny nose and all that for your different drink. But it's important for people to know that that there are different cocktails in a family. For instance, we opened the book with the Manhattan, which has the Rob Roy, the Martinez, the Distrito Federal, the Little Italy, the Star, the Palmetto. Each of those uses a different spirit. Or one of them changes the bitters to Chinar, but for the most part, it's a bedrock ratio of two parts spirit, one part vermouth. Or if you go to the margarita, you can realize that the margarita is 2 ounces spirit, one part orange liqueur, and one part lime juice. Switch that out to gin and add some lemon, and you can have a white lady, or if you use rum, you can have a beachcomber, bourbon, you can have a derby. A cosmopolitan is in the margarita family because it's a spirit flavored with orange liqueur. And that's the basis for this, you know, for a sidecar and between the sheets and cocktails like that. So when you know one ratio, again, just like my cooking ratio, you know 1,000 different drinks.
This is very much aimed, obviously, at folks who want to be able to craft these cocktails at home. And I will say, since I got the book, I happen to have in the house somebody had given me just a very ordinary white rum for a party we were having. And I had a lot of limes in the house. And I happened to have made some simple syrup, the 1-to-1 ratio. I said, oh, I can make a daiquiri. And have been making them following your updated ratio. So 2 parts spirit, 3/4 part lime juice, fresh lime juice, and 3/4 part simple syrup. And man, that is a good, good drink. And it is just right for me. And 2 ounces, going 2 ounces, 3/4 ounce, 3/4 ounce, is exactly the right amount of buzz, especially on a warm summer evening. But it also got me thinking, like, this probably isn't the white rum I would have necessarily chosen for this. And so I'm curious your thoughts on especially stocking with the spirits. With liqueurs and bitters and vermouths, there's brands, it's pretty straightforward. But, you know, thinking of a rum, do you want this aged? How aged? There's such a thing, obviously, is so too aged, too old, that it would be criminal to make a daiquiri out of the Zacapa XO I happen to have in the house right now. So how do you advise people to say, you're going to a liquor store, we have Total Wine here, a billion different options. How do you choose? Which ones do you want to have in the house for your cocktail making?
I think as far as rums go, I would have a white rum, and then I would have a Jamaican pot stilled rum, which are aged rums. They're not that expensive. We had one not long ago in Miami, made by Appleton's. It's really good. Smith and Cross, another terrific rum. So if you are serious about stocking your bar, I'd have one aged rum, Jamaican rum, because it's got a real funk to it. You make a daiquiri with that, and it's a whole different caliber of daiquiri. It's delicious. But you also want a white rum just for those simple drinks or that simple daiquiri that you want to have. Again, it's about your own taste and what you're after. Do you want a Blanco tequila? Do you want a Reposado? Or do you want a more deeply aged Añejo tequila? They're all a little bit different. They add different notes to a drink. And again, there's no one who can really tell you, oh, you must have this Añejo. It's good to have, again, a Blanco tequila and an aged tequila. More important is to have, you know, a tequila, a rum, a gin, a vodka, a bourbon, a scotch. And that's pretty much it. And a sweetened dry vermouth. And I would add orange liqueur, either Cointreau Cointreau or Curacao. And you want a Luxardo. The maraschino flavored liqueur. Those two, which have been used in cocktails for 100 years, are really effective accenters of cocktails. You take a White Lady, which is a gin sour with a white with a frothy egg white, and you add a teaspoon of Luxardo, and you've got a completely new drink. It's absolutely fascinating.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I am a very latecomer to the Luxardo Maraschino because I had about 3 years ago, it was definitely early in the pandemic, found a recipe online for a drink called a Southern Rail, which is very much a rum-based old-fashioned, and it called for a Luxardo rinse first. I was like, you know what? Sure, I'll try that because I know I'll drink that in other things, and was absolutely blown away because, of course, an American, you hear Maraschino, and what do you think, right? The bleached... my kids put on their colors. Sundays. Yes. Right. Ugh, awful. I didn't actually like those as a kid. All three of my daughters will eat them straight out of the jar, though.
I used to put them on ice cream. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
They were good when you were a kid, but not now. And we've got real maraschino cherries now that are available.
Yes.
Thanks to a bartender, Audrey Saunders, introduced, brought them into the market and made a demand for them. And once she, popular bartender in New York, started using them, every bar had to have them. And soon they were readily available.
Yes. Yeah. I'm a huge fan of the proper kind. But it just to sort of follow up on what you were saying, the difference that you get in any cocktail, or even if you do, I don't drink liqueurs straight typically, but I'll always, anything I bring into the house, I'll taste it. See what it's like. The Luxardo is such a different flavor than anything that I expected. And very much a classic little bit goes a long way. A tiny addition. I can't remember what you said to add to the White Lady, but just a a tiny bit at the very end.
Yeah, a teaspoon at the end makes a remarkable impact.
Yep, I can see how that would transform many, many drinks in a good way, especially if you like that particular flavor note. You do talk a little bit about, at the start too, about equipment, which is something, we have a few things because my wife and I just over the years have accumulated items, gifts, etc. But I've never been able to sort of start from zero. What do we actually need? And I'm curious about a few of the essentials. You don't have to go through the entire list of what's in the book, but what are a few of the things that people maybe know less about or less likely to think of getting when they're trying to start to stock a home bar with equipment?
First of all, they need to know that they can probably use just about anything in their repertoire, in their kitchen cabinet, a spoon, mm-hmm. a measuring cup. That's really all you need. I'm looking for this.
I will say I can't, rather than use you discuss the jiggers, I am so bad at those because if I pour, it ends up in the counter. I'm just not steady enough to do that uh-huh. and flip. So I use little Pyrex plastic measuring cups. They're shaped like little beakers. And then I don't spill anything because I don't want to waste the good stuff either.
I love those OXO read from above.
That's what they are. Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Those are terrific. And I highly recommend those. If you actually want to make real cocktails, I think real cocktails ought to be shaken. Those that have a liqueur and a simple syrup and other ingredients of different viscosities need to be mm-hmm. shaken. So you need a shaker. So we get a Boston mm-hmm. shaker. They're not expensive. They're $20, I think, and a Hawthorne strainer. If you want to have a beautiful stirring glass, mixing glass, get a mixing glass and a bar spoon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's it. I have to have a juicer. You find in a grocery store, just those lemon-colored juicers, because fresh citrus juice is absolutely fundamental to a cocktail. I like a big ice cube. It's good to invest in the silicone ice cube that are about 2 inches a piece. Those are great. You should have a good zester, which is like a Y peeler. Mm-hmm. Fruit peeler or vegetable peeler, and I like a strainer, because some cocktails you want to double strain so that you don't have any ice whatsoever coming through the Hawthorne strainer. And the last thing that I love is a hand mixer, hand blender, and mm-hmm. I use this to make batch cocktails, especially with like whiskey sours. I'll put in 8 ounces of whiskey, 4 ounces of lemon lime juice, 4 ounces of simple syrup, and 4 egg whites, and blend that mm-hmm. and chill it with some ice. And then you've got a party full of whiskey sours for people. And they're so good. People keep coming back. You will not have leftover whiskey sours. I guarantee you. They're so delicious.
I wanted to ask you about the ice cube things. We do have the silicone trays to get a large ice cube. I'm holding my fingers up. It's probably close to two inches per side. Mm-hmm. And I'm a believer now, but I have to admit, I also, when that craze first started, I thought, is this just for show? I mean, I understand a little bit of the physics, but is this just so you can put a giant ice cube in my glass? And sometimes I will say, I go someplace, they do an old fashioned and the ice cube is in the glass when there's only about this much actual liquid, which is rather, you know, unwieldy. It's bonk every time you're trying to take a sip. So, my understanding is you are a believer. You do see the practical benefit of the large ice cube. And then what do you think about what I was just describing too? Do you leave the ice cube in the glasses? Do you do it for certain drinks and not for other drinks when you're serving to your guests?
I too had my first response was, this is a novelty. Sure. But then the night my wife Ann and I fell in love, we were at a bar, it was closing down, and we ordered a bourbon, and the bartender looked at us, the bar was empty except for us, and said, you need the big ice cube. And he went downstairs and came up and put big ice cubes in our bourbon. We were married a couple of years later. So that is the effectiveness of large ice cubes.
I'm surprised that's not on the Amazon listing for the ice cube trays.
practically speaking, There's less surface area than with lots of little cubes, so you get less dilution. It makes for a better drink. If you have a really big one, we go one size up, and I put it in like a double old fashioned, and I mix my wife's Manhattan right in there with the big ice cube, and that gives just the right amount of dilution by the time I get it and the Goldfish crackers to her for an evening cocktail. So I love the big ice cubes. I don't like the circular ones. I don't like unconventional shapes. The spherical ones don't really work. But I highly recommend anybody making cocktails that they have plenty of those large silicone trays.
And my wife got us, there were just two, there's six cubes each. They stack really nicely also. And the other great thing is they're very easy to get the cubes out of, which is great. And you can also see at a glance too. Okay, time to refill that one. Refill, switch. It's not like you go through them. Well, we don't go through them particularly quickly. But yeah, I find they make a huge difference. I mean, I'll put them in non-alcoholic things that I'm making also.
Oh, absolutely. Right? Absolutely. But they're really, you know, they're really important for something like a gin and tonic, which is so easily diluted. Yes. And people don't even think about it. People mix a gin and tonic without really thinking about it. You have to have cold gin. You have to have cold tonic water. It helps to have a cold lime. And it helps to chill your glass in the freezer, because otherwise you just get too much dilution and you don't have a great gin and tonic. So we need to think about those things. And, you know, part of that, the greatness of that drink is the proper ice.
Am I remembering correctly, you keep your gin or one type of gin at least in the freezer for that purpose, so that it is cold immediately when you mix the drink?
I keep a bottle in the I keep a bottle of Beefeaters in the freezer, because I often have a martini and I don't want to get out the mixing glass and mix it, and I like it. A martini's got to be really, really cold, and this is the way to ensure it. And what I do is I add a half ounce of water to compensate for the dilution that you would have had you been stirring it. So I do it for that and summertime gin and tonics. Exactly.
Yeah, you almost quoted my father exactly in your feeling on gin and tonic as being the perfect cold, perfect drink on a warm summer night. And now I have become, as we become our parents, as we get older, I absolutely agree with that. And was very pleased to see you are also a fan of Fever Tree, where I think their regular tonic, I know they have multiple varieties. I go for the classic. I just want the classic tonic water. So I find theirs is less sweet. I don't know actually if that's true, or if it's just that the herbal flavors are much more pronounced, the quinine, which is pleasantly bitter to me. My kids even smell that in the house, and they're like, what are you doing? And I'm like, yeah, fine. You stay over there. This is for me. But that's the ideal combination. And now I will be keeping gin in the freezer also after reading your suggestion.
Good. The gin and tonic really is a perfect drink because of that sweetness and the bitter and the gin. They just go so well together. And Fever Tree, I think you're right. It's a little less sweet. In any case, it's a beautifully balanced tonic water. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I grew up, I think we're pretty similar in age, right? You remember the large bottle, liter plastic bottle of some generic brand, or even Seagram's tonic water, which is like, it's just sugar. All I taste is sugar with something bitter in the back there, right? But it's basically just sweet, and that's not good for, I can't imagine what drink that would possibly be good for.
Nor I. And also that tonic water will quickly go flat. Yes. That's another problem with gin and tonics. You've got to use fresh tonic. You've got to just open the bottle. That's why I like the little bottles. They're a little more expensive to have, but they're better in the long run because it keeps the tonic very effervescent.
Last thing I wanted to ask you is, just in general, are there other writers whose work on drink, whether it is directly aimed at, you know, you mentioned a few in the book, at crafting specific cocktails or on the history of cocktails, who you've enjoyed? I was thinking, reading your book too, about a couple of years ago, I read Kingsley Amis's collection, Everyday Drinking, and obviously the man could drink quite a bit.
Boy, oh boy.
Oh, but his thoughts were delightful, actually. And this was obviously a man who took his drink very seriously. And well, I think that was actually somewhere in there. He was the one who made me a believer in, even if you're just having a straight spirit, you've got to drink it cold. Because I'm personally a rum drinker, as you could probably infer, and generally have a couple of good sipping rums in the house. And it has to be cold. I'll drink it neat eventually, but I've got to chill it And that's kind of what got me on this whole train. So as you're talking about this in the book too, I recognize all of this. This is the same that we're all following the same tree through history of people advancing our knowledge of drink and how best to consume some of these things. So I'm curious what writers inspired you, or who do you just generally enjoy reading, historical or contemporary, on drink?
I know the Kingsley Amis book. It's fabulous. There's a book called The Hour. The author escapes me from the 50s. It's a lovely tome. Contemporary writers who I really like are David Wondrich. He's the, you know, he's the leading authority on cocktails in the country. He's got a great book called The Oxford Companion to Spirits and Cocktails. I like all his, he's got a number of books. He's a terrific writer, a great thinker. I enjoy Brad Parsons' books. He wrote a book called Bitters. He has a book on Amaro. And Robert Simonson, he's the drinks writer for The Times and writes a number of smaller books, like Classic Cocktails is a lovely book that just came out that's by Robert Simonson. So those are some of the writers who I like. Oh, and if you like martinis, you have to dig up Roger Angel's essay on the martini. It's superb.
My guest today has been the great Michael Ruhlman, whose newest book, The Book of Cocktail Ratios, The Surprising Simplicity of Classic Cocktails, is now out in hardcover. It came out right at the end of May. I have recommended for years many of Michael's books, including the original book Ratio, Ruhlman's 20. I don't think I mentioned Egg, which I use all the time also. And you can find more of Michael's thoughts at his Substack, Ruhlman, Ruhlman.substack.com. Michael, thank you so much for joining me.
It has been fun. Thank you.
That's all for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. Stay safe.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.